I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. This week, we are joined by reporter Julia Bergman, who talked to us about recent racial incidents at the Coast Guard Academy. And she caught us up on the recent Navy review of its training and basic seamanship following two deadly collisions involving Navy surface ships. Reporter Erica Moser also stopped by to give us an update on the state budget that was signed by Governor Malloy. Can you talk to us a little bit about the alleged racial incident that occurred recently at the Coast Guard Academy?
Basically, on Monday of this week, October 30th, the superintendent of the academy held an academy-wide meeting to discuss the incident, and we obtained audio from that meeting. We were denied access to the meeting, but we did receive audio, and in that audio, the superintendent, Rear Admiral James Rendon, explains what happened, and as he tells it, a white male cadet went into the room of a black male cadet and started playing a song on his personal computer, the black cadet's personal computer, and we've never explicitly been told what the song was, but the superintendent described it as a song that many consider offensive and that romanticizes the world in which the South won the Civil War.
I received word that a white cadet reportedly walked into an African-American classmate's room playing a song that many consider offensive, a song that romanticizes a world in which the South won the Civil War. The African-American cadet told his classmate he believed the song was racist and left the room to discuss the encounter with one of our diversity peer educators. Upon returning to his room, the African-American cadet discovered that the background screen on his laptop had been changed to the image of a Mississippi state flag, a flag that includes the battle flag of the Confederacy.
And actually, this incident happened just a couple hours after the Commandant of Cadets, Captain Melissa Rivera, was having a discussion with the whole student body about a separate incident that had happened in the spring that also involved a Confederate flag. And that incident was investigated as a possible hate incident, but was determined there was no evidence of that ultimately. And that involved a picture that was posted on Instagram. I believe the posting was actually, it was on a private Instagram account, and it shows two white male cadets. Their backs are towards the picture, the camera, and they're dressed in civilian clothes. They have red hats on, backward facing, that say Make America Great Again. That's obviously President Donald Trump's campaign slogan. And just in the picture on the window next to them, a Confederate flag is hanging from the window there, and the investigation into that incident as a possible hate incident found that there was insufficient evidence to establish that the cadets were motivated by any kind of bias against race, color, you know, religion, anything like that.
So how are these two incidents that you just referenced related, if at all, to your recent reporting in which you spoke to four cadets about what they perceived to be systemic racial discrimination at the academy?
So I would say there's no relation, but I think that, you know, it obviously shows that these kind of discrimination incidents are happening on campus. You know, the four minority cadets, you know, described a situation or experience that's different for cadets of color than it is for their white peers. You know, one of the arguments that the cadets made was that incidents of discrimination aren't taken as seriously as incidents of drinking, for example, or even sexual harassment or sexual assault. And cadets have two basically formal ways that they can report discrimination. One is through the academy's anti-harassment hate process, and the other one is through their discrimination complaint process. And so we got some data on that. In total, there was almost 50 reports, but that's just reports that have gone through these official channels. So there's probably way more stuff that has happened that is just being reflected in those incidents. Obviously, people who don't report or didn't report through these formal methods.
And what time period?
We asked for data from 2007 to 2017, or what's happened so far in 2017. And of the incidents reported through the official discrimination complaint process, there were 24 incidents in total, and those were reported by both cadets and faculty and staff. None of them resulted in a finding of discrimination. And then of the reports that went through the Academy's anti-harassment and hate process, there was 23 reports also by cadets and faculty and staff, and only 6 of those were substantiated. So, you know, that shows that in a lot of cases there's the outcome, at least according to the investigation, is that the discrimination didn't happen or isn't happening.
Any official response from the Coast Guard Academy?
Yeah, so as I said mentioned earlier, we got an audio from the superintendent's remarks on Monday to the entire academy about the incident, the most recent incident. You know, he basically said that the school wouldn't tolerate this kind of behavior, racist behavior of any kind. You know, said if you can't sort of live up to these expectations, that you need to get out. This isn't your academy. That's sort of the type of tone he was taking. He also alluded to an incident that actually happened involving the preparatory school for the Air Force Academy. So there were some racial slurs scribbled on the whiteboards on rooms of several black cadets, and the superintendent of the Air Force Academy, although it happened at the preparatory academy, came out with very strong remarks, sort of saying something similar. Sort of Rendon echoed what the superintendent said, which was, you know, this: if you're going to execute this kind of behavior, then you need to get out.
No matter what is going on outside the walls of this academy, we must not let it weaken our honor and our core values. As members of the Coast Guard, with the central core value of respect, we must aim higher. We must demand more. After the recent incident at the Air Force Academy, I sent each of you an email with the video of that superintendent saying that if his cadets could not treat each other with respect, they needed to get out. As I told you then, I share General Silveria's views. All of you know that I am one of the biggest cheerleaders of this academy, but today I am disappointed, I am upset, and I am angry. We are a humanitarian service with a mission to help others. And how in the world can we do that if some of you can't even respect and take care of each other? Right here. In case some of you aren't paying attention when Captain Rivera was talking on Thursday, or you're not paying attention right now, let me say it again. Well, the facts matter. We will not tolerate racist behavior of any kind. If you fail to heed this message, you don't belong here.
What does leave work now mean to you? What does it imply?
It implies that wherever you're sitting listening to this, it is not as fun as what you could be doing.
Exactly. We're the harbingers of relaxation.
It's your job every day to go and do what other people would consider fun. So this podcast is sort of like going along with you.
You want to go with me the next time I attend a Yanni concert?
Now with Rick Koster. Find us on theday.com or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's talk about the Navy review of possible gaps in training and basic seamanship following a couple of high profile and accidents that led to fatalities. Can you get us up to date on some of those accidents and what the review recommends?
Yeah, so the comprehensive review comes after a rash of accidents that happened earlier this year involving Navy surface ships in the Pacific, and two of those accidents were deadly. And so the Navy investigated each of those incidents separately, but also called for a comprehensive review to identify any sort of systemic factors that contributed to the accidents.
What did the review find?
Yeah, so the review found that, there's a sort of go-go-go mentality, a culture of not wanting to say no. You know, the Navy has a lot of demands on it to keep up, you know, the operational pace. And so shortcuts have been taken to meet that demand. It found that in many cases, the surface fleet in the Western Pacific is inadequately prepared for emergency situations. There's gaps in basic training and seamanship, people not knowing how to operate equipment that they are operating, that type of thing.
And you mentioned rising operational demand. Can you explain that a little bit? Does that mean more deployments?
Yeah. So, you know, there's been a big debate in Congress about how many ships the Navy needs. President Donald Trump has called for about 350. That seems to be the number that a lot of people are settling on right now. At last count, the Navy, I think, had about like 274 ships. So, you know, that's they're being asked to do a lot, you know. And you have ships that are going on longer deployments. They're not getting maintenance when they need to be getting maintenance. And so that type of, you know, trainings aren't necessarily getting done when they need to get done, that type of thing.
Recommendations from the review and any comments that we've seen?
Yeah, so I mean, some of it is like basic stuff like, you know, trying to increase stress management resources for sailors, things around sleep. Others are bigger, like ways to address training inadequacies and things of that nature. One of our representatives, U.S. Congressman Joe Courtney, he actually sits on a pretty powerful subcommittee in Congress that deals with issues on sea power in the Navy. And so he was obviously briefed on this. And, he thought a top priority should be that setting up a command that's solely responsible for manning, training, and equipping Navy forces within the Pacific Fleet. Right now, that doesn't exist. It's sort of it's a job that is also combined with other responsibilities. So he thinks that, you know, there should just be a command that's solely focused on that. He also said that there could be some practices from the submarine force that could be applied to the surface fleet, like ensuring that sailors are 100% qualified on any new equipment before a ship goes out to sea, that type of thing.
So anything else that we can expect to come from this review or subsequent looks at the accident?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely going to be more hearings in Congress. I think there's definitely going to be pressure on the Navy, both internally but also externally, to implement these recommendations and these reviews and to make sure that that happens.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, it's the Sports Doctor, Keith P. O'Brien. If you want a different take, if you want a different angle, a different way to view sports, well, check out my weekly podcast, and I will show you the way from a fan's standpoint. We'll bring you great guests, local, national, athletes, coaches, players, you name it. I'll bring it to you. Sports Doctor Podcast, right here on theday.com.
Erica, give us some details about the budget that Governor Malone just signed this week.
He signed the budget 122 days after not having a biennial state budget. That's for the fiscal years that are officially called fiscal years 18 and 19. The issue has been a projected $3.5 billion deficit. So the governor's executive order had gone into effect, and that was stressful for a lot of cities and towns that were losing a lot of municipal aid under the executive order. I know Groton was really struggling. They had been getting about $25 million in education cost-sharing dollars, and under the executive order were losing all but 7 million of that. So that would have just been devastating had that stuck throughout. But Groton actually came out pretty well in this budget compared to some other cities and towns. There previously had been 30 alliance districts in the state. That includes Norwich and New London. And now Groton was added as an alliance district, as were two others in the state, bringing the total up to 33. And being an alliance district means that the students aren't scoring quite as well, so they get a little extra state aid. So that means now that Groton, like Norwich and New London, is being held harmless in this budget, is not losing any ECS money, whereas pretty much all the other local cities and towns are seeing 5% cuts in ECS. Again, still not nearly as high as what you were seeing in the executive order, which ranging from 50 to 100% cuts for some of these cities and towns. Overall, this is a $41.3 billion budget. And the legislators have made clear this was very much a compromise budget. There is still a lot of work to do. Still, it's going to be a difficult process 2 years from now. And when I say compromise budget, the Senate passed it by a 33-3 vote on October 26th. And then the House passed it by a 126-23 vote later that day on October 26th.
Which made it a veto-proof.
Yes. So that budget was the concern, that in September, this GOP budget had been passed with a few Democratic votes, but then the governor vetoed it. So even before the governor had signed this budget, people thought, you know, okay, this is going to pass, it's veto-proof. And he did indeed sign it. This was on October 31st. And he signed it, but he did exercise his line item veto power on the hospital tax. So the legislators now have to go back. And what legislators have been saying is that it's not so much the idea that the governor was at odds with, but that there's some issues with the language that they have to fix.
Can you talk about some of the local response to the budget? I know that there's been a couple of meetings, right? There was the Groton Budget Forum and another meeting.
So I was kind of saying to some legislators on Thursday that I was sort of on double duty for getting the legislative reaction. In the morning, Senators Paul Formica and Kathy Austin, respectively, Republican and Democrat, and they're the co-chairs of the Appropriations Committee, they came to the day to talk to a few people here. And then in the evening, I went to the Groton Senior Center, where there was a Groton Budget Forum with Senator Heather Summers, who's a Republican, and Democratic Representatives Joe Dela Cruz and Christine Conley. And all three of them are in their first term in the General Assembly. So this has been quite a first term to have. Another person who I did see at the Groton Budget Forum was Representative Chris Soto. He was not on the panel, as he's a New London representative. And he also was one of three people in sort of in our local area to vote against the budget. The other people in our in this area who voted against the budget were Mike France, representing Ledyard, and Doug Dubitsky, representing Chaplin and then parts of Norwich. So I did speak with Representative Soto last week about why he voted against the budget, and he just felt that, you know, it wasn't really fair to some of the poor residents. He was, you know, against that this Huskier insurance program would be cut for some people. Interestingly, at the Groton Budget Forum, Representative Dela Cruz, who did vote for the budget, was saying that Huskier was one of the things, you know, you really have to kind of grit your teeth and bear with, and that this is part of the compromise. He was saying that, you know, before going to Hartford, you have these ideas in your mind of where sort of the line in the sand and what your lines are, and you get to Hartford and realize just how much negotiation is necessary, right, and that those lines don't really exist. And I think especially with a House and Senate so close, I mean, the Senate's 18 Democrats, 18 Republicans, that makes it even tougher for negotiating. You know, some of the legislators, of course, are trying to promote some of the positive aspects of the budget amid this really difficult budget season. So that includes the elimination of the Social Security tax on middle-income filers, aligning the estate tax with federal levels, a requirement for the legislature to vote on union contracts, and then a 90-day limit on state departments to respond to permit applications. So for permit applications, that would be like Department of Transportation and Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Now, of course, then the revenue has to come from somewhere. So there has been an increase of 1% in the pension contributions for both judges and teachers. There's also been an increase in the cigarette tax. I'd mentioned earlier that there are some cuts to Husky-A, and it's in some parts of the budget, it really is like a bit of cuts here, a bit of cuts there, a bit of cuts there. And when I talked about ECS funding, previously the rule had been to hold districts harmless so that they're not going to get less money one year than they did in the previous budget. That is no longer the case, which means, again, a lot of these districts are seeing 5% cuts from the previous budget.
So that 5% needs to be made up by the towns, and so budgets to come probably
to be aware of. And some of these towns really have been planning for this. Some of them were planning for more than a 5% cut. Just based on what they were hearing back in the spring. So some are fine. Others, you know, it's still a struggle. And for some towns in our area, they're saying they feel this is unfair because they say, we've been doing a great job managing our finances. We're fiscally conservative. We're very prudent with where we put our money. We've been increasing efficiencies, and they feel that they're getting punished for that and that money is then being taken from them to help parts of the state that they feel are not managing their finances as well. So that's a frustration for some people. And you see that now with local elections, that it's not, even though you have local candidates running against each other, it also feels like they're running against the state.
Right.